This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we will visit with biographer J. Michael Lennon. His target is Norman Kingsley Mailer, the great American writer who lived 84 years and died in 2007, had bestsellers in seven different decades, one of the giants of American letters, and one of the most celebrated public figures of his time, the novelist, journalist, filmmaker, serial philanderer, father of nine, Norman Mailer. We'll talk about his remarkable life in print and elsewhere with J. Michael Lennon. Also on the show, a rabbi who flew below radar and was the spiritual advisor for President William Jefferson Clinton for many years. We'll talk with Rabbi Menachem Ganach. Now the news. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Your numbers are 877-217-5757 outside Baton Rouge, and in the city, 297-5633. You may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. Our guest is J. Michael Lennon, Emeritus Professor of English at Wilkes University, and the biographer of Norman Mailer, one of the giants of American letters. As J. Michael Lennon notes, nothing characterized Mailer more than his unbounded ambition. He wanted not only to be the greatest writer of his generation, but a writer great enough to be compared to Tolstoy. He even had presidential ambitions, although he settled for running for mayor of New York City. Championing personal freedom and civil liberties, calling himself a left conservative, yet he was enemy number one of the women's movement. He was as pugnacious in real life as he was in print, engaging in famous feuds and fights, and they're all detailed in Norman Mailer, A Double Life, from our guest, J. Michael Lennon. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning. Good morning, Jim.
Nice to talk with you, Professor. You first met You first met Norman Mailer when?
1972.
He was promoting a book, wasn't he?
He was on a book tour, as he was often, and he was in Illinois, where I was teaching at the University of Illinois, and I brought my Norman Mailer class up to meet him. And one thing led to another, and we ended up in a bar and talked till the wee hours, and I found him to be remarkably open. You know, it was the first time I met him. We'd exchanged a few letters, but it was a terrific moment in my life.
And over the course of the next 35 years, you remained relatively close, I guess as close as anyone could be with Mr. Mailer.
Yes, Mailer had many friends, and many people thought they were his best friend. I certainly felt that at times, because he was a very warm, open person. He was always curious about other people, not just curious about people like Marilyn Monroe and Muhammad Ali, but curious about his neighbors, his friends, people he met on the subway. He was probably the most accessible major writer of that time. And I enjoyed my time with him. I'm from New England, too, and he used to summer there, and so I would go up with my sons and wife every summer to spend days with him. And then, of course, later on, I moved to his hometown just to be near him while I talked to him and interviewed him.
Well, you're described as his official biographer. But if you read The Double Life, and I'm sure many of our listeners will, almost 1,000 pages on the life and times of Norman Mailer, you'll know that this is not a puff piece by any means.
No, I tried not to make it a puff piece because, first of all, I didn't approve of or admire everything that Norman did or said. And secondly, it was important to get the public record straight. And you know, make sure that his fights with the feminists and his fights with Gore Vidal and so forth were all actually recorded in the book. So I tried pretty hard not to make it a hagiography.
Did he like to fight?
He liked to fight. Well, you know, he had a mixed feelings about it. He said, you know, I'm not in love with violence. Who likes violence? Nobody likes violence. He said, but, you know, there's times where you just have to stand up for what you believe in. And you have to fight if you need to. And there was also, he liked to do some sporting fighting, as he called it. You know, sparring in the ring or headbutting, which was not a favorite of anybody's but his.
Well, there's the famous altercation with Gore Vidal at a posh party in New York City. That might have been Mailer's last big fight, if you can call it that, but it's yeah. detailed in your book.
Yes. He was very mad at Gorbadal, and he had been for a long time, and he said, I just couldn't take it. When I saw him, I just threw a drink in his face, and that led to a scuffle between them, and the people at the party, the hostess was appalled. She said, this is terrible, and it was the New York editor there from Esquire, and he says, shut up, this fight is making your party. And it was, I guess, the last famous literary brawl of Mailer's life.
But ultimately, those two obviously had much in common. They became friends at the end.
They did. They were both they were both lived for many years in New York City. They were both ambidextrous. They wrote fiction and nonfiction. They were both terrific essayists. They were both outspoken public figures. Their politics was the same. And so it was inevitable that they should be brought back together again. And indeed, in right toward the end of Mailer's life, Gore came to Provincetown for a week, and they put on a play called Don Juan in Hell with four characters in it. Mailer's wife, Gore, Norman, and I was the fourth character in a minor role. It was one of the great weeks of my life to sit at the bar with Norman and Gore and listen to them reminisce about Truman Capote and other characters they'd known.
297-5633. The book is A Double Life from J. Michael Lennon. Norman Mailer is the target, and as I stated, well over 900 pages on the life and times of Norman Mailer, which went from 1923 to 2007. He had bestsellers in seven different decades. He was a remarkable man, and the focus of your book, Michael, is that Mailer believed that in each of us there are dueling persons, like two different people in the same person.
That's right. And it came out of his own young experience living in Brooklyn in a tough Irish neighborhood. And, of course, he was Jewish. And his family spoiled him to a fare-thee-well and protected him and coddled him and praised him. So in the house, he was a little prince. But out in the streets, it was a different story. It was tougher. And so he noticed just from the early part of his life that he had these kind of two sides to his life. One, he was out on the street and had to watch out for all the Irish gangs that were there. And when he was in his house, you know, he was, in effect, sitting on a throne. And that continued for the rest of his life. He always saw these opposites. They weren't always the same. They changed over time. But for every Norman Mailer, you know, you have to turn him around and see the other side. So he was a terrific family man. His children loved him. But in the other, he had numerous affairs and six marriages. So he was a leftist in some ways, but he was very conservative in other ways. He was very conservative about the environment. He was very worried about democracy. He Northerner, but he had great affection for the South. He married two women from the South. And he served in the Army with a Texas outfit, and he always revered those Texas boys that he served with over in the Philippines.
Well, he graduated from Harvard in 1943 with honors, 20 years old, goes to the Pacific in World War II, and writes about that experience in the book that defined him, and many believe his greatest work, which was published when he was 25, The Naked and the Dead.
It was a remarkable book for someone so young to publish, but there was a foreground to it. While he was at Harvard, although he was an engineering major, he took all of his minors in creative writing, and he produced 30 short stories, two plays, and two full-length novels, and a novella, about 500,000 words before he was 20 years old. So he knew how to write. An amateur novel. This wasn't the novel of an aspiring writer. This was the novel of a writer who had already been published, who'd won prizes. He was precocious, very precocious as a writer.
He admired Hemingway a great deal.
He did admire Hemingway. He was not without criticism of Hemingway, but he admired him a great deal. He thought that Hemingway's prose style was so impressive that, you know, it changed the course of American literature, and there were so many imitators of Hemingway. And he admired Hemingway's personal life, the way he was very involved in sports and skiing and boxing and so on. And there's no doubt that Mailer, as an early writer, emulated Hemingway to a certain extent. But he felt tremendously let down when Hemingway committed suicide. And he pondered that suicide for the rest of his life and wondered, he wondered why it happened and why Hemingway didn't leave a note. And he felt that Hemingway had left his literary family and his admirers bereft with no clue as to what was going through his mind. But, of course, we know that Hemingway was seriously depressed and had all kinds of problems and had tried to commit suicide more than once before he ultimately succeeded.
Well, it was shortly after Hemingway's suicide that Mailer stabbed one of his wives. He went through some difficult times himself and was suspected of being mentally unstable.
Yes, he was. He stabbed his second wife. Actually, it was just before Hemingway. He stabbed her in 60, and Hemingway died in 61, I believe.
Right.
And he wasn't trying to kill her. I mean, he was drunk. He was drunk. He was angry. She was provoking him, and so forth. Their marriage was falling apart, and he reached in his pocket. He had a little penknife, and he just kind of poked at her with it. And of course, he wasn't trying to hurt her, kill her, but it punctured the side of her heart, and she went in for major surgery. And luckily, she survived because he didn't hit the heart. So it was one of those bad luck, good luck thrusts. And, of course, it haunted him for the rest of his life. He never got over it. He never wrote about it. He spoke about it. He spoke to me about it in his last years. He felt that he had let his family down, that he let God down, that he had done a dirty, lousy, cowardly thing, as he said in court. And it took him some years to recover from that situation, which his family and friends called the trouble.
He was concerned, as you write, that incident would keep him from being viewed as an authority or as a valid analyst of life at large. He had some issues about what kind of currency he would have as a result of his felonious act against his wife.
You put it perfectly. You put it perfectly, Jim. He was afraid his works later on would be seen as the work of a deranged person, and so he insisted to the psychiatrist that he was sane. He was crazy. He was angry. He was wrong. He was in a depressed state, but he said, "I was still sane." And they said that, they didn't understand how a Jewish man could be involved. He said, "Have you heard of an act of passion?" It didn't register with them that a middle-class Jewish intellectual could commit an act of passion. It was a new thing for them in their book. And so he had trouble convincing them, but ultimately, a psychiatrist took a chance on him and he mended slowly.
How did a man of his talent and adulation have so much anger within him?
Again, that was one side of him. One side of him was angry. He was very worried about the way the world was going. He was worried about the distribution of wealth in the country. He was worried about the environment. He hated plastic. He was worried about politics. If he were alive today, he would be terrifically upset over the situation in Washington. That was all on one side, and on the other side of him, and there were also personal things he was angry at as well. He was angry at the way he had been treated in the 50s by the literary world, dismissively. On the other side of him, he was a very funny guy. He was a lot of laughs. I mean, he had a lot of being with him was a pleasure because he was interested, curious, funny. His dinner tables conversations were always fantastic. You know, a dozen people around a table. And conversations on everything under the sun, and Norman goading people on, and telling jokes, and he was so there was a lot of joie de vivre in his life too. He wasn't a bleak person by any stretch of the imagination. But sometimes you'd walk in and you could just see the dark cloud over his head.
297-5633 is your number. The guest, J. Michael Lennon, the biographer of Norman Mailer, the book A Double Life, about the man who won Pulitzer Prizes for Armies of the Night and the Executioner's Song. Will return with Michael Lennon after this 90-second pause. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. The guest is J. Michael Lennon, the biographer of Norman Kingsley Mailer. A Double Life is the book. Fresh off the press and the New York Times in its weekly section, the book review section, Sunday, gave a nice review to the book. It was the cover story of this week's Sunday Times. 877-217-5757, inkstershow@wrkf.org. If you have an observation about Norman Mailer, or if you'd like to pose a question to his biographer, J. Michael Lennon. I mentioned the seven decades of best-selling books. The depth of his career as far as duration and the different kinds of topics that he embraced with such vigor and such clarity, I don't know if anybody compares with him as a writer in his time.
Gore Vidal probably comes the closest because he wrote probably as many books as Mailer. Was his peer as a public figure, and also did a lot of. Gore Vidal ran for public office just like Mailer did. They also had that in common. Vidal came the closest. Mailer was an immensely curious guy, and he was a quick study. And so you could give him a manual on the rocket going to the moon, and he was an engineer. He could sit down and read it, and then parse it out and explain it. He's very good at explaining technical things. He was a great good explainer of the country, and that's one of the things he wanted to do was explain America to itself and pose questions about its destiny and its past. And so he'd finish one thing, and the next thing you know, he'd be off to write about Marilyn Monroe or Muhammad Ali, and then back to serious political journalism, writing about prize fights and writing about the CIA and writing about American history. In the first part of the 20th century, I think John Dos Passos wrote a huge novel called USA. I think Mailer could be compared to him.
Bruce and Walden. Bruce, you're on the air with Michael Lennon. Hi, Bruce.
Yeah, hi, Jim. Yeah, I always enjoyed Mailer. He made a lot of public appearances on kind of talk shows like Merv Griffin at one point in his career. Did he ever comment on that, whether he found that useful?
Norman enjoyed it. He enjoyed it tremendously. And at the beginning, he didn't really know how to do it. And he tried to give long speeches, and they failed miserably. And he was on with some people like Truman Capote and Gore Vidal, who were master of the snappy comeback. They sounded like Johnny Carson, and he sounded like a long-winded preacher or a politician. But he learned over the years how to control himself, how to pace himself. And I don't think Merv Griffin is one. He was on Mike Douglas. He was on David Frost, Johnny Carson, many times with Dick Cavett. Charlie Rose, I think, a dozen times. So he must hold some kind of a record for most appearances by a major writer on American talk shows. And there are a lot of people that just know him because they saw him on television. that's their knowledge of him. And, you know, Mailer hoped that some of them would eventually go out and read some of his books.
Well, my first exposure to him was as a kid, and I saw it live. It wasn't a live show, but I saw it when it aired the first time with Dick Cavett and Gore Vidal and Norman Mailer, and I thought, this guy's amazing. the audience didn't receive him well that night, though.
No, they didn't. They didn't, but in a way, he changed the rules of the talk show, because he brought the audience into the picture. He insulted the host. He fought with the guests. He asked questions. He turned his chair around to face them. I mean, he did all kinds of things you weren't supposed to do. But some of the reviews of the show said, you know, television is getting interesting now. It's not just people that are on there hawking their new book or their appearance in a film, which many talk show appearances were all about. It was as simple as that. He says these people are talking about ideas and they're fighting about stuff that can be important. And so Norman wanted to elevate. He wanted television to be more like public radio, when there was a lot of back and forth and good conversation.
Well, in retrospect, many of his failures along the way ultimately became triumphs. The interview with Cabot and Vidal is one that now I think Mailer is given the nod to as the one who dominated that night.
Yeah.
he wrote a book that you mentioned, Deer Park, that was not well received at the time, but through the years it has been much better received. And he sent a copy to Ernest Hemingway, didn't he?
He did. He sent a copy. He was very worried about the reception of the Deer Park, his Hollywood novel. So he sent out inscribed copies to about 20 writers. And he said that, you know, he felt badly about doing it. He was he felt he shouldn't have done it, that they, because there were writers that he didn't know. They weren't friends. And Mailer didn't know Hemingway at all. And Hemingway, the book came back from Cuba. And it looked like it was in the same wrappings, but Mailer couldn't be sure. So he didn't know if Hemingway had opened it, looked at it, to send it back to his wife, Mary, or whether it, you know, there was something wrong with the Cuban postal system. And he found out, several years later, 5 or 6 years later, that Hemingway never received it. And Hemingway then wrote him a letter and said, look, I never got the book. And I'm sorry about all this. And he gave Mailer some advice about stop worrying about things. He said, you're never going to get anywhere in life or love or literature if you're worrying all the time. And Mailer was very pleased to get that letter from Hemingway.
Well, he was, like Hemingway, a man fascinated with pugilism. And Norman actually got in the ring with some professional fighters along the way. But Chuck Klosterman has called Mailer the best boxing writer of all time. His association with Muhammad Ali is a curious one, isn't it?
It is indeed. It is indeed. They met in Las Vegas in 1963. They hit it off. They both had big egos. They both wanted to be the greatest, and of course Ali was the greatest. And Norman wrote about him more than once, but his most important book is called The Fight. And it's about the rumble in the jungle, his 1974 fight with George Foreman in Kinshasa, Zaire. And I think that Klosterman is referring to that, as well as his other pieces that he wrote for Life magazine. Mailer and Ali got along. He came to Mailer's 75th birthday party with his wife. I got a chance to meet Ali and talk to him. He was very generous, and they just hit it off. They were good for each other. They boosted each other's egos, and of course, when they got together, they pretended they were going to box like all prize fighters do.
Well, Mailer had a celebrated fight not only with Gore Vidal, but also with Rip Torn. Was that one for real?
Well, yes, it was. It wasn't. It set up was doing a film called Maidstone, and it was about a presidential candidate and who was a movie director. And the idea this was during the assassination summer of 1968 when Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy and were killed, and Andy Warhol was shot. And the idea was that there was a group of people trying to kill him, and there were a group of people trying to protect him. And the movie went on in this state of kind of unbearable dread. And finally, Bourne knew the whole premise, but decided, this film is never going to end unless I attack Norman T. Kingsley, which was the name he used in the film. And he did attack him and hit him in the hammer, and Mailer bit his ear, and his ear got all infected. It was a big mess. But ultimately, Mailer realized that he had implicitly encouraged Torn to do this, forgave him, and put that fight at the end of the film, and it really makes the film.
Richard Downtown, you're on the air with J. Michael Lennon. The book is Norman Mailer, A Double Life. Richard.
Yes, Jim. There's a Louisiana connection that Mr. Mailer had. In 1964, I took a creative writing course at Louisiana Tech. The professor was Francis Irby Gaughtney from Arkansas. And it's my understanding that Mr. Gaughtney and Norman were in the Army together during the war and remained friends at least through the late 60s.
Yes, well, actually, they were friends right up till Fig Gaultney's death. They had fallings out and fights, but they always got back together. And Mailer helped set up a scholarship for him, for Gaultney, out in Arkansas. And it was through Fig Gaultney that Norman Mailer met his sixth wife, who he lived with for the last 30 years of his life. She was an Arkansas girl named Barbara Davis at the time, and she became Norris Church Mailer. And he was very fond of Fig, and he wrote probably as many letters to Fig as anyone except his first wife. He must have written Fig over 100 letters, and they're terrific letters. I quote from a number of them in the book. And they hit it off because they both like literature, and they used to sit in a foxhole in the Philippines and talk about Thomas Wolfe. Mm-hmm. So he was Mailer's oldest friend, and until Figg died at a fairly young age, he choked on a piece of meat, I believe. They were good friends, very good friends. Mailer used to visit him in Arkansas all the time.
Yeah, and that's, as you say, where he met Norris in Russellville, Arkansas. And
right.
She was the defining person in his life over the last 30 years. He treated her miserably at times, but she mm-hmm. loved him. She was on this show shortly before she died. There's no doubt they had quite a connection.
Oh, yeah. They did, yeah. She was a real great gal. She died in 2010. We're dear friends of hers, and miss her terribly. Yeah, she could handle Norman. You know, she was the one woman who really tamed him in a way, because she could move with him. She was like a boxer who knew how to fend him off and how to deal with him, and she could put him in his place when he needed to. And when he started having affairs after 7 or 8 years of marriage, she said, "That's it, I'm leaving you." And he basically got down on one knee and said, "Please don't, you can't leave me, you're the love of my life." And after some back and forth, which was pretty rough, they made up, and, you know, she's buried next to him now in Provincetown, Massachusetts, where they had a home.
Phil in Jefferson Terrace, you're on with Michael Lennon. Hi, Phil.
Good morning, Jim. Yes, sir. My question is, the armies, about the Armies of the Night. It was such a vivid piece of work, and I thought it was a bit different than his normal style. I mean, he took you there, and it was a novel that was not of his generation. He was talking about you know, people younger than him and what they were doing, and actually that's a time a lot of people don't remember. There was a lot of rioting and blood in the streets of Washington that summer. Could you talk about the research he did for that?
Sure. I can tell you, because I've looked at all of his papers, that he did no research for it. He did some research later, but when he was marching in that anti-war march in October 67 in Washington, D.C., he didn't have any idea he was going to write about it. He felt he was just going down there because he was obliged to, because he was against the war in Vietnam. And when he came back, he thought, gee, you know, I might have a pretty good short story here. And then his editor, an editor at Harper's Magazine, Willie Morris, and his agent said, you know, why don't you write something nonfiction about it? And so Mailer did, and it was supposed to be 20,000 words, and it grew and it grew and it grew until it was over 100,000. He wrote it in 6 weeks. And the only research he did is he went back and he talked to people like Jerry Rubin, Noam Chomsky, David Dellinger, folks like that that were in the march, about the organization of the march and the groups that were in there and who was in them. He was getting down all the journalistic nuts and bolts that he needed for the second half of the book, which was briefer. As you remember, the first half was very vivid, as to use your word, which is exactly correct, in describing the young protesters and the chaos of the march. The second half of the book is where he steps back and he kind of gives you some historical context for it and talks about what groups were involved and what their relationships were and so forth. But that was the only research he did for it. And, you know, he wrote it, the march was in October 67, and the book was published, you know, first as a magazine and then as a book in the spring of the next year. So it was some of maybe his best book, and he wrote it in the shortest possible time.
How did the Jack Henry Abbott affair affect Mailer?
It affected him very deeply, very profoundly. He had written a letter for Jack Abbott, who was a criminal, a very smart criminal, a writer, to help him get out of prison. He didn't get him out of prison. Many people say Mailer spearheaded it, which is not true. Mailer and half a dozen other people who were impressed with Abbott's writing wrote letters. But then Abbott, it was learned later, snitched on some people in prison, and that was how he got sprung. He got out for that reason. And then Abbott was out for 6 weeks. He was a very bitter, angry person who had been in prison for 30 years, and he didn't know how to mail a letter. He didn't know how to buy pants in a store. And Norman and Norris helped him a great deal, especially Norris. And then one night, he thought somebody was threatening him, and he killed him with a knife. And Norman was deeply wounded by it, and said that, you know, he had blood on his hands. He said, "I have blood on my hands." He felt very, very badly about it. I don't think he ever got over it because the person was just a young man of, you know, I think 21 or 22, 23 years old, an actor, and was sort of the night manager of this restaurant in New York City. So it was a very, very painful experience, and he caught more criticism for that than anything he did in his entire life.
Well, the life of Mailer paralleled many lives. He was born in 1923. President Kennedy was born in 1917, and Mailer had a fascination with him. He called him a god. One of his most remembered pieces was Superman Comes to the Supermarket in 1960. What about his reaction to Camelot and Kennedy's assassination?
Well, Mailer always said that Kennedy was the most important historical figure in his life, that he had affected him more than any other figure, more than Hemingway, more than Herman Melville, more than any other writer or person. And Mailer really wanted a seat at the round table at Camelot. He wanted to be Kennedy's advisor. And he thought that since he had written this wonderful essay before the 1960 election, Superman Comes to the Supermarket, that had certainly aided Kennedy's cause and conceivably, you know, added a lot of votes to his totals, Mailer thought that, well, maybe the president will invite me down to the White House for drinks and dinner, and I'll give him some advice, because Mailer was always ready to give advice to the president all the time. He was always writing them letters and telling him what was wrong and what they should do, and he thought that's what you do in a democracy. You know, you can tell the president what your ideas are, and he said, I could have helped the president. I could have helped him do this and that. And Jackie Kennedy wrote him back a letter and thanked him for that essay and said, I hope we can get together again. And that's when his ideas got Napoleonic, and he thought, well, I'm destined for big things here, and I'm going to run for mayor of New York. And this was the first time in 1960. And, of course, the night he was going to announce it is the night that he stabbed his wife, and then everything collapsed and fell apart. But he revered Kennedy for the rest of his life. I'm a character in one of his novels, a minor character in An American Dream, that novel, and spoke about him all the time, and then toward the end of his life wrote about him in Oswald's Tale. He wrote, and he came to the point where he was ready to write about the Kennedy assassination, and his account of it is in that book.
Did he think Oswald killed Kennedy?
Yeah, good question. He went back and forth. At first, he thought it was a conspiracy, and then when he read all the KGB tapes in Minsk in Moscow with Larry Schiller, his collaborator back in the early 90s, he said no one would ever trust this guy. He was such a nerd and a jerk. No one would ever trust him to with an assignment like this. No intelligence agency, no spy agency would do it because he was such a loose cannon. And he said, I'm 75% convinced now that Oswald did it alone. But then later in his life, novelist Don DeLillo told me when I interviewed him that Mailer told him now he was again thinking that indeed there might have been a conspiracy. So,
hang tight. We'll be back to wrap it up with J. Michael Lennon, a remarkable book about a remarkable person, Norman Mailer, back in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. In just a moment, we will hear from Rabbi Menachem Ganach. He was a spiritual advisor to President Bill Clinton. Some might find that surprising, but we finish our talk with J. Michael Lennon, the biographer of Norman Mailer, A Double Life. And there's no doubt that with the 50th anniversary of the assassination of JFK, 1 month and 1 day away, Mailer would be writing about what happened in Dallas on November 22nd, 1963. And as we were going to the break, Michael, you were saying that he vacillated as far as believing whether Oswald did it or if there was a conspiracy.
Right. He never could decide. He went back and forth. And because he had Mailer was sort of a conspiratorialist. He was always saying, you know, the job of a novelist is to look below the surface and see what's going on there and try to anticipate some of the conspiracies and the miseries that are out there that we only find out later when the media reports. Journalists do that as for their living, and he said, and novelists have to do it too. So he had a kind of an ear and an eye for conspiracies. And it was such an earth-shattering event that he believed that Oswald might have done it, and then the evidence pointed the other way. So he was completely ambivalent about that. And, of course, there are many people in this country that are still ambivalent about it, still doubters out there that think that the Warren Commission report didn't really solve anything.
Well, as we close, Mailer during his life vacillated between belief in a higher power and not believing. And in the end, one of his last works was appropriately about God.
Yes, it was his last work. I interviewed him over a course of 3 years, and the idea was to publish the book after he died. But then as he got toward the end, he said, let's publish it now. He said, I'd like to get it out there. I'd like to have one more book on the table. And so when he was dying in his hospital bed, I remember bringing in New York Magazine with his picture on the cover that had excerpted it. And he was very pleased that book got out there. And he explored his very interesting and unconventional ideas about God, which I could not possibly explain to you now. But they're worth looking into. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Michael. It's a pleasure. Michael Lennon, the book is Norman Mailer, A Double Life. And we're joined now, speaking of God, by Rabbi Menachem Ganach. He was an associate of President William Jefferson Clinton for many years and has written about it. The book is Letters to President Clinton. Good morning, Rabbi Ganach.
Hi, good morning.
You met him on the campaign trail, I guess, when he was running for president the first time, correct?
Yes, in 1992.
1992. Where did you meet?
I met him in New Jersey. There was an event at which he spoke, and I introduced him. And at the time, there was a lot of scuttlebutt about President Bush's lack of vision. Time magazine had an article about it. Bush mockingly used to call it the vision thing. And when I introduced Governor Clinton, I said that Scripture tells us that when there is no vision, the people perish, and that vision is an essential ingredient, therefore, of leadership. He said, you know, I like that. And he enjoyed the remarks. He said, I'm going to use that in my acceptance speech at the Democratic Convention, which he did, and it became a central rhetorical theme in his speech. He used it, pivoting, coming back to it, and that's how the relationship began.
Well, and along the way, you exchanged correspondence. Clinton is a Southern Baptist. How did he take to a rabbi?
Well, we actually became good friends. The correspondence continues to this day. But what it tells us, first of all, is that the message of the Bible is a universal one, even though I was speaking, obviously, meaning it from a Jewish perspective. And as you say, Bill Clinton's a Southern Baptist. The other thing it tells us is about the president's intellectual curiosity, that different cultures, different religions, different approaches are of interest to him. And the other thing is his amazing openness to new ideas. You know, Toni Morrison famously said that Bill Clinton was the first black president. So, you know, different experiences and this openness, which was an important theme in his presidency, you know, the commonality of humankind.
Well, you write that ultimately Clinton's legacy will be not only America's economic renewal, but a more tolerant and connected society. Why do you believe this?
Well, you know, it's ironic in a sense. You know, I think Bill Clinton, you know, that openness, both in terms, you know, of course, many different borders, racial borders, religious borders. He would often speak it, which I think he has also, you know, has in the foreword to the book about the research in the genome, and we see how the more we research our DNA, we see how more we are alike, and that I think that's part of the legacy that he gives. There's a certain irony here because I think because of that, in his openness and trying to build bridges, in you know, racial bridges as well, across the racial divide, you know, he helped create the environment that could elect Barack Obama, the first black president in the United States, even though he was, of course, in the primaries Hillary's opponent.
Well, in the foreword, President Clinton writes, over the years, these individual missives were invaluable to me in addressing the challenge of leadership and public service. I'm delighted to see this collection published. I can only hope that its wisdom may enrich others' lives just as it did mine. You're an Orthodox rabbi, correct?
Correct.
Okay. And some would think this is quite unusual for a Southern Baptist from Arkansas to find wisdom and solace in the company and words from you, but he did. Did he talk with you at all during his impeachment trial?
Yes, he did.
How did that go?
On one occasion, he asked me, you know, what this was, I guess, after the Ken Starr grand jury his testimony. And he knew he was going to ultimately speak to the nation, and he asked me what should he say, and I said, well, first of all, express profound remorse, but also he should indicate the presidents also have a right of privacy. And I don't know if that was politically such good advice, because at the time I think people were critical of that. But I think it's very, very true. And especially in our media-driven world, these barriers are breached, which shouldn't be. And I thought they were breached during the impeachment process. The way I sent them a letter about it, you know, with biblical reference, the Talmud asks, why is it that animals in the creation weren't given the capacity to speak? And the answer that's given is because if animals could speak, we have to remember in an agrarian society, they're ubiquitous, they're all around us, our dogs, cattle, and so on. They would tell all our foibles and failings, and it would be impossible to survive. So what the Talmud is trying to tell us is, it's not just we say the right of privacy, it's more than a right, it's an existential need, because it's built into creation. And I think Ayn Rand said that without privacy, civilization would collapse. We would be just barbarians.
So after you meet in '92 on the campaign trail in New Jersey, who followed up? How did you end up becoming fast friends?
Well, afterwards he invited me to the White House several times, and I gave him a letter with a. Had given already a few, just with a biblical theme, and one of them was about Judah and Joseph. This was towards the beginning of his first term. People were critical. Some said, you may have had some rough time initially, the first 100 days. And I gave him a missive saying, why is it, with this question, why is it that Judah in the Bible is chosen to be the leader, the kingship and the house of David? Comes from Judah as opposed to Joseph. Joseph seems to me so much more suitable. He was a ruler in Egypt. He ruled brilliantly, saved the country from famine, reorganized the economy, seemed perfect in every way, never gave in to temptation. Why Judah? And so what I suggested was the Bible tells us that Judah, in his relationship with Tamar, ultimately admits to that. And the word Judah in Hebrew, Yehuda, means the etymology also means to admit. And that what we look for in a leader is not perfection, but the ability to admit a mistake, to be flexible, not to be wedded to a disastrous policy. And when my daughter typed this letter and I gave it to him, she typed Genesis 28 with the story of Judah and Tamar. It's Genesis 38. The president gently, he sent me a handwritten note, you know, saying, by the way, it's Genesis 38.
Is he a complex man?
He is a complex man. I think what you see in this book, and I think what the American people have gotten to know about him is that, first of all, he's extraordinarily smart. He's very curious. This whole book is a testament to his intellectual curiosity. As you said, he's a Southern Baptist. I'm Jewish. And very open-minded. And also, I think they see, especially in his post-presidency, the extraordinary work that he's doing in terms of simply he saved millions of lives with the work that he's done through the Clinton Foundation, the Clinton Global Initiative, done very important work in terms of curtailing AIDS in Africa and getting medicine to them at much cheaper cost, and he's worked on climate change and governance. And, you know, I think that's why he's become such an admired figure, a global icon, him, the Pope, you know, Mandela. There aren't many like that.
Well, quite often we hear politicians, mostly from the conservative side, say they're seeking God's guidance about various things, whether to run for office or not, or whether to go to war or not. most of them say they read the Bible, even if they don't. Is Clinton a student of the Bible?
Oh, very much so. You know, I have some stories there. Just Martin Marty, who is a distinguished Christian theologian and historian at the University of Chicago, told me this story. He actually has a piece, a letter that he wrote to the, that I'd asked him to write to the president as well. But there was a group of many Christian leaders and of all different streams, evangelicals, Catholics, different Protestant denominations, and one of them who remains unmentioned, but he tells the president, he says, "Mr. President, I'm praying for you." So Clinton asked him, "Well, what are you praying?" And he quoted a verse in Chronicles, and he said it was Chronicles 1. Clinton corrected him, "Well, you know, that's Chronicles 2. So, you know, his knowledge of the Bible is and his interest in it is deep. I'll just tell you another story. When Ron Brown, Secretary of Commerce, was tragically killed in a plane crash in 1996, Clinton wanted to include one of Brown's favorite verses in his remarks when he was going to speak at the Commerce Department, so he asked them to find out what that was. And they only had about a half hour to, you know, compose the speech. So after some consultation, they came back with a paraphrase of the verse, but no one knew the exact wording. The president scanned the text and told an aide, "Oh, this is from Isaiah 40. It sounds like the New English translation. I prefer the King James Version," which he, in the middle of the speech, then quoted by heart. "But they who wait upon the Lord, they shall renew their strength," and so on. So he's very familiar with the Bible.
The book is Letters to President Clinton from Rabbi Menachem Ganach, an Orthodox rabbi from New Jersey who met Bill Clinton on the campaign trail in 1992, and they became friends at that time. And you write that in the next few years, the president graciously included me in joint prayer meetings, delegations to the Middle East, state dinners, and other events. I would prepare a brief essay containing insights from the Bible that I felt would help him navigate whether national issues he was facing, whatever national issues he was facing, and pass it along to him. At a certain point, the Secret Service, you write, Rabbi, objected to you handing documents to the president personally. Why were they not happy about that?
Well, you know, I would put this letter in an envelope. It could leak, you know, it could be misunderstood and look unseemly, so... The president suggested, "Why don't we set up a formal process," which he did. You know, first it went to his secretary and then to Ann Lewis. And today it goes to his went to chief of staff and to Hannah Rickert.
Well, some might think that the president courted you because of it. Politically it might be a good thing to have a rabbi as a friend, especially for a Democrat like Mr. Clinton. But this correspondence and friendship that you had with him, it's continued well beyond his presidential years, hasn't it?
Right. I don't think there's a political dimension because it didn't come out during his presidency. This is 20 years after it began. So
so it's genuine. You and your wife are friends with Hillary as well, right?
Yes.
Do you think she will run for president? Do you think she'll run?
You know... I have no more information than anybody else. My initial feeling was that she wasn't. She was so tired after, you know, being Secretary of State. But I think at the end, I don't see how she doesn't run, you know. I think just in the sense of both beyond ambition, that's always part of it, but also in terms of there's just no one as qualified as her. I think she'll do it.
They celebrated their 38th wedding anniversary last week. Despite their problems, which have been detailed, they appear to be a compatible duo.
Well, you know, many respects, they're so similar because they're both their interest in public policy. They're both so smart, and they're both, if you get to know them, they're very, very gracious, you know, open people.
During the Lewinsky affair, though, I'm sure the president was tortured about what he had done to his family.
He said so explicitly.
Yeah, and his words were reflective of that, but they got through that. Some folks would cut and run. The Clintons stayed together. Now, there are skeptics who say it was for political reasons, but there appears to be great love between Bill and Hillary.
I think that's very true. I'll just tell you an incident. You know, when I thought about putting this book together, this goes back about 3 years ago now. I gave him, you know, an initial. I put them together with some comments, and I gave him the manuscript. And he said, you know, I really like it. I'm going to write the foreword. And the next day, I was invited. There was an iftar at the State Department, and Hillary came over to me and said, you know, Bill called me last night and told me about the book. I think it's a great idea.
Well, Rabbi, we got a roll on that one, but thank you so much. And the book is Letters to President Clinton from Rabbi Menachem Ganak. Thank you for joining us today. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.